Welcome to Homegrown. I'm Brian Kahn. Mike Mansfield was perhaps Montana's greatest statesman. In the late 1990s, we had the privilege of interviewing him. This is what he had to say.
It's hard to describe the career of this program's guest, but let me take a stab at it. Early on, grocery delivery boy. A little later, sailor, soldier, marine, Montana miner, history professor, United States congressman, United States senator, Senate majority leader, statesman, ambassador. You must have guessed by now, I've got to be talking about Mike Mansfield, a man who has been both witness and a significant participant in a good deal of what has transpired in the United States in the 20th century. Senator, thank you for taking the time to meet with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
I was surprised to read that you actually were born in the East Coast.
Yes, I was born in New York City in 1903. My father and mother were Irish immigrants, and I was the firstborn in my family in this country.
Big family?
My mother died, leaving behind three children. My father remarried, moved to Montana from New York, where he was a hotel porter, and had an additional three children, so between two wives and one father, six children came into being.
And you got to Montana about when?
1909.
I read somewhere that when you were delivering groceries, one of the guys you delivered groceries to was Charlie Russell. Was there any truth in that?
Yes, I pushed a grocery cart when we didn't use the horse any longer. My granduncle, with whom I was staying, had a grocery store. I never saw Charlie Russell, but I did deliver groceries to his house, and I did hear about him in the Mint Saloon when I sold empty bottles and things of that sort to that, quote, institution, unquote,
yeah.
on Central Avenue.
I also read somewhere that you'd done a little boxing. Was that true?
Very little boxing. I went to the School of Mines in Butte, spent 1 year there. I hadn't finished the eighth grade when I ran away from home, so I enrolled as a special student, and during that time, our football coach, Charlie McAuliffe, used to get us in the ring once in a while with each other, and we did some boxing. Nothing to really talk about, and certainly nothing to brag about.
I recently tried to get back into boxing and found out I'd aged a little too much for that sport. You learn in a hurry.
You do.
How did you get into mining itself? You actually worked in the Butte mines?
I worked in many Butte mines during the 20s and the first year of the 30s. After I had been in the service with the Marines in the Far East, I came back to Montana, came back to Great Falls, couldn't find anything there, didn't feel like going to high school that age. I wouldn't have been eligible anyway because, as I said, I hadn't finished the eighth grade. But I did go to Butte and got a job at the Colorado mine on West Park Street as a mucker. And following that, I worked at various other mines throughout the city.
I think myself and a lot of other folks wouldn't know what a mucker is. We're probably not in touch with what mining has been.
He's a shoveler. And in the mines, you never worked alone. You usually had a miner and a shoveler working together for safety reasons. And eventually, of course, I did become a miner at a day's pay of anywhere from $4.25 to $4.75 a day. Not much money, but it meant a great deal more in those days than it would today.
You said first year of the 1930s. This was in the starkest period of the Depression then.
Yes, we were. But while I was going to the School of Mines after I'd finished my first year there, just barely, I met a Butte girl by the name of Maureen Hayes. We've just recently celebrated our 67th wedding anniversary, And whatever I've accomplished in life, she's the one who deserves the credit, although I'm the one who usually gets the honors. But she pushed and pressured and did everything possible to get me to finish the equivalent of a high school education, to go to the University of Montana at Missoula as a special student, and to eventually graduate in 1933. In my last quarter, I earned my last of 15 credits to be a high school graduate, and on that basis, I became a regular student. So she's the one who made me what I am, pushed me, as I've indicated, and is responsible for what we've made of our lives together.
Quite a bit. Now, as a guy who worked in the mines and saw the conditions and the illnesses, silicosis, whatever, did that have a significant influence on your political philosophy?
It did. It's what we called miner's con because of the copper water and the copper dust you came in contact with. It shortened your life. It didn't give you much in the way of opportunities to better yourself. My wife-to-be, Maureen, was very much aware of it, and that was one of the reasons, among others, that she wanted to get me out of the mines and into the fresh air more often.
What was her background?
She went to St. Mary's, Notre Dame. Her father used to run a coal dealership in Butte. She taught in the elementary schools, finished up at Butte High School, left her job there to come down to Missoula to make certain that I did my work and was able to eventually graduate from the university.
Let me go back to the Depression. Roosevelt's elected in 32. You've been working in the mines. That period, in hindsight, is seen as representing a radical transformation in the definition of American government in terms of its responsibility to support the basic needs of working people and citizens. How did it look to you at the time, and how does it look to you in hindsight?
I would agree. I think Roosevelt was a blessing. Like John F. Kennedy, decades later, he gave people hope. I will never forget the Depression. No jobs, prices very low, freight car loads of people going back and forth across the continent, desperation in everyone's view. And Roosevelt gave us hope, made promises which he tried to carry through, achieved a degree of success. But if it were not for the Second World War, not too much would have been achieved. It's ironic that to think that if that war hadn't come, the Depression would have lasted so much longer, but that's the way it actually was.
Now, there was a lot of radicalization in American politics during the 30s with this prolonged economic crisis. Labor unions became very active, and I guess you had the unionization of the auto industry, the CIO. What was your cut on all that at the time?
I felt that what the unions did was necessary. I felt that the automobile companies, which fought them, had to come to terms. Out of it came a relationship, which at first was hostile, but which I think has reached an agreeable status today in the relationship between industry and labor unions. It was a sea change as far as industrial relations were concerned. It was long overdue, and it brought about a better degree of livelihood for many, many Americans.
It's interesting. I'm just reading a book by Studs Terkel called Coming of Age, where he interviews folks in their 70s to 90s. And he describes a conversation with a guy who said that he loathed unions. And Terkel said he was feeling in a mischievous mood, and he said to the guy, how many days a week do you work, and how many hours a day? He said, well, I work 5 days a week, about 8 hours a day. And he said, well, the reason for that is that somebody's great-grandfather fought for those rights for you.
That's right, and the automobile industry is a good illustration of it.
This is a question I'm going to come back to in several contexts, but when we look at the historical experience that you just described and the, on balance, as you said, sea change and concrete progress that working people made through unionization and the struggles, why do you think that the leaders of industry opposed it so vehemently? For example, Henry Ford and the big owners of the automotive industries fought like heck against the unions they hired. We call it paramilitary now. They had their own police forces. They fought the legislation. Under the New Deal, was it the NRA or whatever, the National Labor Relations Board? All of this stuff was seen as an attack on American freedoms and capitalism, and Roosevelt was called a traitor to his class. A lot of that revolved around what we consider now to be basic economic justice issues.
Well, they were living in the past and refusing to pace up to the present and to look forward to the future.
Mm-hmm.
And it took bloody action, and I use the word bloody advisedly, to bring about a change in a situation which had become embedded in the American economy. But out of it came higher wages, 8-hour days, 40-hour weeks, and eventually other benefits, pensions, health care, and the like, which are now a part of the American economy insofar as labor and industry are concerned.
I want to read something that you said. The essential ingredients of a healthy and secure society are good education and health, decent living conditions for all, a safe and clean environment, and the absence of poverty. Now, in the context of those social goals and the progress, substantial progress we've made, I guess, as a nation toward them, although we still have many, many people who live in poverty, I want to discuss with you a little bit about something I understand you're involved with now in terms of your work with Goldman Sachs. You're involved, I guess, directly in the globalized economy and the flow of capital all over the world now. President Clinton not too long ago was saying that, and he's an advocate of globalization, I think he said two things. One, it's a fact of life. Two, we need to work to make sure it does not become a race to the bottom. And what I gather he meant by that is something Pat Williams commented on in an interview on this show about export of capital to areas where living standards, environmental protections, and wages are much, much lower. Do you see a risk to the living standards of Americans or the industrialized nations in this transition process to a more global economy? And if so, what should we be doing about it? How big a problem is it, or is it not a problem?
It is a problem which has to be understood. The world is shrinking. Information is instantaneous. Distances are being shortened. Television is bringing different cultures to different parts of the world. Akio Morita, who used to be the head of Sony in Japan, referred to globalization as developing into a global village. I would say we're developing into a global neighborhood. And whether we like it or not, we're being drawn more closely together. We're neighbors. We have to understand that there are differences. They will be bridged. And that, after all, no matter what our color, our religion, our caste, or whatnot, we are members of the human race, and we will be drawn closer and closer together in the years, the decades, and the centuries ahead.
Before we continue, Senator, in case any of our listeners just joined us, I should let you know we're having the pleasure and privilege of talking today with former Senator Mike Mansfield. Do you see, continuing on a little bit in this question of globalization, economic risks to the standard of living? In other words, we're now, let's say, competing with Chinese computer literate graduates who work for, I don't know, $11 a week or, you know, and long hours, very competent people. And all over the world you have that. Just sort of common sense, and I'm not saying it works, but it would seem as though with an increased supply of labor, skilled, educated labor in the former communist world, that this would have a downward pressure on wages and benefits and even environmental protection. Are those concerns misplaced, or do you share them?
No, I share them, at least in part. I think we have to protect the environment. We have to advocate human rights for all people. We have to practice it ourselves at home. We have to recognize that there are different cultures based on different foundations, and while we can't equalize into the foreseeable future, a evening of the wage and hour structure, I do think that there are beginnings being made, especially in places like East Asia, from which we import much in the way of materials and furnish them with surpluses, that there will be, and there is in the process of being, take Nike, for example, changes occurring which will increase wages, which will better living and working conditions, which will allow people to participate more in the activities of the countries in which of which they happen to be citizens. And I think out of it will come a greater degree of understanding and equality, and hopefully a higher standard of living which will apply to all people on all continents in due time. Not immediately, but the first steps are being taken now, and I think that we can take some credit in this country for our advocacy of human rights and the bettering of conditions of human beings in all parts of the globe.
You know, you mentioned Nike, and it rang a bell with me going back to these automotive guys. Nike just didn't step up to the plate. There was a lot of publicity. I think the unions were involved in generating media coverage of the working conditions in some of these places. And I just saw not too long ago, I guess the head of Nike said that they're going to now apply the same standards for working conditions, not wages in their factories. It just seemed again an example of the reluctance in, for reasons that are inexplicable to me. These guys must be decent guys that run that company. I don't know why they didn't respond more quickly. Any thoughts about that?
I don't think they really understood the conditions as they existed, and they were aware, of course, of the fact that labor was cheap, that labor was skillful, and what they did raise the lives of many people, despite the low wages they received, and they were, at heart, unaware of just how decrepit the lives of these people were, but how better. They understood how much better they were in comparison to what it had been. So let us hope that what this company has done to better conditions in Indonesia and China and elsewhere where they have factories, others will do the same. And I think they will, because I think circumstances will force them to do so.
You said something about our interdependence very eloquently there, and I want to read another short quote that you made. You said, "Our interdependence is a fact that we deny at our own peril." Did you find that folks have a tendency not to be able to see the fact that we are interdependent and must work out common solutions?
Yes, I used to feel that way myself. I had to learn the hard way. To repeat, the distances have been shortened tremendously. Information is instantaneous. If you go contrary to what you quoted me as having said, it means that you're an isolationist. Mm-hmm. I used to be an isolationist. Probably still am at heart, but I try to face up to reality and recognize that I have no personal choice as to what the future will be, so I better make the best of it and do the best I can to get along with other people. Events are forcing themselves to rethink our past thinking, our past sense of values, and to recognize that in reality we have to face up to certain things in a new kind of life, a highly technical, and that we are integrated each with each other. That we are not islands unto ourselves, but parts of the whole. As such, we have to do what we can to make the world a better place for people to live in and to guide ourselves by the standards which have been set by other nations as well as ourselves in order to get by and to become a partner with other countries and other peoples.
We interviewed Shirley Johnson, who is a highly placed official in the United Nations Nuclear Disarmament Agency. I don't remember exactly what it was, but she's been involved in a lot of these inspections and in these trouble spots. And she was commenting on the international nature of the teams who go in to do the looking, and the importance of having people from different cultures in those teams, because you just can't force people to cooperate. I mean, that's what it boiled down to. And unless we all worked together, she was saying, and were sensitive to other cultures, we couldn't do the job of policing these potential nuclear weapons and export of all this dangerous stuff. Now, one of the things that struck me hearing her was that that has serious implications for the basic question of national sovereignty, or the basic issue of national sovereignty, as does, it seems to me, globalization with increasing, I guess it's corporate, multinational corporate capacity. It seems that the nation states have less power to call their own shots. Now, am I missing something there, or do you think there are valid elements to it, and is it good news or bad news?
No, I think it's moves which are taking place with or without our approval. We have to accommodate ourselves to this new era. We have to realize that while we are the dominant power in the world today, that does not mean we should be the dominating power. I think we've used sanctions too freely and too often. They often do more evil than good and bring about difficulties which are hard to overcome. But there can be a mutual meeting regarding national sovereignty as such, pride in your own country, as well as a globalization which will occur, whether we like it or not, in so many aspects of our lives. It's going to be hard for some people to accept it, but in a sense we have accepted it in the United Nations, for example, in the way it carries out its responsibilities, although we haven't lived up fiscally to paying our dues. It is a step forward. It is a move in the right direction. It is a necessity as the world shrinks, as the problems come with more rapidity and develop at a higher degree of intensity,
uh-huh,
and bring about changes which we find hard to accept, but have no choice but to do so.
Let me shift gears to another issue that I'm keenly interested in your observations about, and that's sort of the future of democratic self-government principles on which this nation was founded. And I note that your tenure in the United States Senate and the United States Congress is just about one-sixth of this nation's history, which is an astonishing reality. Would you say you're optimistic or pessimistic or hopeful, or how would you characterize your views about the future of our democratic experiment, and what are the reasons for your feelings?
We're having our difficulties, and we'll have them for years, perhaps decades to come. But basically, democracy, despite its weaknesses, and it does have some, is the best form of government because it gives the opportunity to the people to participate, if they will. One of the reasons that I became so interested in voting was because there was a lack of voting on the part of the people as a whole in elections, and I felt that they should increase, should participate more fully, should make their views known, and the best weapon they had was the ballot box. I became interested during the Vietnam period, although I felt this way before that period, that 18-year-olds should have the right to vote.
Uh-huh.
If they were old enough to fight, they were old enough to vote. So we passed an amendment to a bill, which was eventually, which was signed by the president. The amendment was passed to the Judiciary Committee, and it became a part of the Constitution of the United States, I think the 26th Amendment. So there are so many things that those of us who are older can't keep up with that we find it difficult to understand what's happening underneath. But democracy is the strongest and the best form of government, despite its weaknesses. It gives the people the opportunity, if they will take it, to express themselves, and hopefully it will improve with the passage of time. More people will become interested, more voting will take place, and more decisions will be made on the outside rather than just in the halls of the Congress.
It's such an interesting thing how easy it is for all of us to take for granted what we inherit as opposed to what we participate in earning. And the history of democratic government is very recent and a product of great struggle. And it is astounding that so many of us take it fairly casually, the right to vote and influence government. I sometimes take it casually myself. You mentioned Vietnam, and in my own case, your appearance on my horizons of awareness came during that period when I was a college student, and I was always struck. You brought a different aspect to the discussion at that time. I want to read something that you said. This was a speech at Indiana University. I have no desire to indulge today in what has been a kind of parlor game called Who's Winning in Vietnam. It is offensive to me, as I know it must be to you, to hear this deadly conflict treated as some sort of athletic contest. The lives of too many young Americans are on the line in Vietnam. Too many bewildered men and women and children are being burned, bloodied, and broken by this war. Too much is in ruins. Too many lie dead. Vietnam is not a game. There can be no winners. There are only losers. Now that is a remarkable statement of humanity, not just policy, to me as I read it 30 years later. How does it sound to you?
Just as true today as it was then.
When you look back at that time, how did we do all those things? How did so many people become so blind to what you could see?
It's hard to say, because we blundered our way into an area which was in no way connected with our interest. We took up a cause for which there was no possibility of victory, and we sacrificed in the process pretty close to 60,000 dead, 300,000 wounded. At one time, we had 575,000 men in Vietnam. For what? The American people finally awakened to the facts involved. They made their feelings well known, and they were able, at long last, during the time of President Ford, I believe, to bring about a culmination, the ending of a war in which we should never have been involved, and which cost us a great deal. The deaths can't be revived. The wounded really can't be cured. The costs will be tremendous because it will take us down into the middle of the next century to pay off pensions, disabilities, and the like. And the mistake was one of the most horrendous we could ever make. I hope we've learned a lesson that we will consider our own interests primarily, and that we will understand them in relation to others, not through war, but through talking, through treaties, through entreaties, and bring about a sort of a brotherhood, if we can, which will bring cultures together and bring more understanding to the people of the globe as a whole. No more Vietnams. They go contrary to our interests, and we do not turn out as winners, but in the long run, we have paid a terrible price for a misadventure which should never have occurred.
Senator Mansfield, I want to thank you, not primarily at all, for being on the show. I want to thank you for that, but I want to thank you on behalf of many, many people around this country, not just in Montana and Wyoming, for your distinguished service on behalf of this nation. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Home Ground Radio is a production of Artemis Common Ground and is pre-recorded.
All opinions expressed by guests or the program host are solely the responsibility of Homeground and do not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. We welcome your comments and suggestions for new programs. Write to us at Homeground, P.O. Box 748, Helena, Montana, 59624.